I remember it. It was an undergrad media class at college. This film got to me, deeply. Anyway, I get home and I immediately go to my mom. Mom, Mom, I sat in class today and we saw this film called Perfumed Nightmare. Have you heard of it? The filmmaker's name is Kidlat Tahimik. Wait, Tahimik? Doesn't that mean quiet? Or still? Silent? Yes, anak, she says. And Kidlat, that means thunder. Ay, hindi, no. It means lightning. Lightning. Quiet. It is vision and it is sound. Light, the essential component of film. Silence, the absence of sound. But it's not light. It is lightning. It is a flash. And it is silence. Kidlat Tahimik, born on October 3, 1942 in Baguio City, Philippines, was actually born with the name Eric Deguia. Anyway, Kidlat is a filmmaker of magical repute. His film, Perfume Nightmare, is probably one of the most cogent, playful, scathing, and loving films that encapsulates a colonized Philippines. And it's not your studio-produced historical narrative, like that crappy John Sayles film, of which I will not name, because I'm still mad at losing that time sitting there. Anyway, Perfumed Nightmare is a playful treatise, a testament to the plasticity of film, how tactile and malleable the form is, and how that can be used to break down and understand the source of a historical melancholy. After Perfume Nightmare, Kidlat produced 8 works that continued to be mindful of indigenous and deeply rooted Filipino culture. Every film a reminder of the slippage between modernity and pacing your heart with the planet's pulse. And every film a reminder of living with laughter as a critical force. I sat with Kidlat earlier this week at the Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley, where they're hosting a retrospective. And just before this stop, he was caught up in New York with Hurricane Sandy. How's your stay been so far?
I've been on the road for the last month and I had exciting encounters. At least I watched the elections.
Yes. And what did you think?
Well, I think from outside, we don't want to get involved, but it's just that it seems like somebody else started the problem and why. I couldn't understand why the voters were so split. Mm-hmm. But it's like that also in the Philippines. Whoever's the incumbent gets blamed for everything. Yeah. And the other encounter was with Hurricane Sandy.
Yes.
I was in New York.
Uh-huh. What part of New York were you at?
I was in the Anthology Film Archives, which is 2nd Avenue and 2nd Street.
Right there in Manhattan.
Right, yeah. And... yeah, my last 3 days of screenings got canceled because there was no electricity.
No power, right.
I was staying with a cousin in Chinatown, and we would have to cross the Brooklyn Bridge to charge her cell phone. I mean, we're used to blackouts and we're used to typhoons in the Philippines, no?
Yeah.
Bawat linggo, especially sa mga buwan ng... Can your audience also think?
Oh, well, if they can't, then I will translate. Don't worry about them. Yeah.
Yeah, pag rainy season, the months of July, August, September, there are lots of, at least 20 typhoons hit the Philippines. Of course, not everywhere the same place, but you're likely to get between 5 and 7 typhoons that will affect your area because the Philippines is so small.
Right. And then ang grabe ng baha.
Grabe ng baha, and then grabe ng amag, you know, the sun doesn't come out. Isang buwan na wala, hindi malabas ang araw. Everything gets moldy. But you get used to it, and I was kind of amazed. Kasi, yeah, I remember Katrina, the typhoon in New Orleans, and but like for months and months, it was still the same. They're still discussing it, but it was more always about the material damage, no?
Mm-hmm.
And I think if the media always treats it like that, it makes people have entitlements or feel they have entitlements. Why doesn't the helicopter rescue me? Or why doesn't food arrive on time? Which, it's good to know that there's some sources of social aid in times of calamity. But if you're immobilized and you're just waiting for those 200 helicopters that you're entitled to for relief and rehabilitation, then sometimes you don't just pick up the shovel and do it. And at home, you have no choice. Yeah. Even if there might be one or two helicopters, the chances is that half one of them is not working. Mm-hmm. So you just pull up yourself up by your bootstraps. I think it's a kind of, I think when once you're living in the industrial society where machines are expected to do most of the physical work, relieve you of the physical labors, but it's also that these machines are the ones that have to be coordinated pagka may disaster, you know, in times of disaster. So then it creates a certain mindset that makes you feel helpless and you, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and you're frozen in your tracks.
Would you say that kind of expectation, would you say that same kind of expectation of entitlement is the same in the Philippines when the typhoon hits?
Not really. I think people just get resigned. Their native intelligence will bring them to places where you're not likely to be swept out to sea or things like that. Of course, you can never tell now because flash floods happen everywhere. Now, I just mean that in the end, your ability to be creative in terms of pulling together your creative energies and your what to do next, and maybe you're more connected to nature. You have instincts what to do. And you live in a society where there's a manual for the escape door is this way, your evacuation route is that way, and wait for the signal to do this or to do that. Maybe that creates this kind of detachment, being so far away from the realities of. But it's funny because I have typhoons in most of my films. You've seen Perfume Nightmare, I become the awakened typhoon. Of course, it's a metaphor for awakening culturally and releasing our energies as a people. When I opened my film in New York, 26th of October, I opened with Perfume Nightmare. And I'm blowing down people at the end of the film. Yeah? Mm-hmm. 2 days later, here comes Sandy. Maybe she thinks she's invited to the party and blows down Manhattan's power lines.
Can I just say that I was introduced to your work in college as a film major at UC San Diego, and your film really opened up for me a new way of understanding my identity and also how to play with the film vocabulary, play with that plasticity. I did a short film on 16 when I was, I think, 20, called...
Oh, you worked with 16.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Called Ang History ni Philip. Mm. And in it, I went ahead and I inserted a time-traveling friar. And there's a statue at my old home of Jose Rizal, and he's in front of a supermarket. And so I used that location and had him talking, his ghost talking to my character.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I thought you, when I read in your email that there was a supermarket that happens to have a statue of Rizal in front.
Yeah.
Ah, there was. I thought you were just now said that you set it up.
Oh, no, hindi. It's actually there.
Yeah. But that's in San Diego, no?
Oh,
makita. I was once traveling in Australia, and I was surprised to see in one of these secondhand shops a full life-size bust of Jose Rizal. Mm. Well, it just closed the day we passed by, but I don't even know how he got there.
Yeah. Well, that's a funny story in San Diego, and I think it was part of the centennial. A bunch of U.S. organizations that were connected to the Philippines were allowed these busts, and they put them wherever they saw fit. Mm-hmm. And so whoever was in San Diego thought it would be appropriate to put it in the supermarket, or mm-hmm. in front of the supermarket. It's interesting. Yeah.
You know, last year was the 150th birthday of Jose Rizal, mm-hmm. 2011. And we were trying to organize the artists were trying to organize some kind of celebration with that event. Anyway, we're all familiar with most of the statues of Jose Rizal. He's in a overcoat. He's wearing an overcoat, a suit, and carrying his Western books. And so it kind of emphasizes, visually anyway, it emphasizes kind of the Westernized veneer of our great hero. And I tried to exploit that, since that's what we mainly see, and I think it has some kind of effect on how people view Rizal. He wrote in Spanish, his novels, he studied Western medicine so he could operate on his mother's eyes. He had studied some Western irrigation that he applied to in Dapitan. But people forget that what was the source of this adaptability and this energetic vitality of somebody who'd become our national hero. And so I had, you know, I live in Baguio, and a lot of my best friends are Ifuga wood carvers. So we did a collective work where they carved Rizal, like standing on his monument, and his coat is open, and underneath his coat he has his bahag, his G-string, whether it's a spiritual G-string or a literal G-string, that doesn't matter. It's just that, where did this genius get his strength? From his indigenous roots. And I think he was always connected with them, even if he was very Westernized.
I wanted to interview you in a bahag, but I couldn't find one in time. Yeah. But can you talk about your deep connection? You've been touted as the indigenous, kind of a wordplay on indigenous. Can you talk about how that has sustained you in your film career and your arts career?
Well, let me give proper credit to that word. I've been the one spreading that word, but it started with my best friend. He's an elder from Ifugao. And he was educated as far as high school, and he has a good command of language, but he has a very thick Ifugao accent. But he would always mispronounce the word. We indigenous people are often taken for granted. Our indigenous culture is looked down upon by our Manila brothers and sisters. So I saw it as a cosmic mispronunciation. Wow, he combined the genius of the indigenous cultures, which are still relevant today. So I like that. And what I did was, since I was teaching in UP at the University of the Philippines, mga estudyante ko gumagawa na nila yung mga diploma films nila, graduating students, I would tell them, look, as you do your diploma films, don't forget to tap our indigenous strengths. I said, I like the way Lopez Nouya mispronounced the word, so why can't I also further twist the word? So indigenous, why indio? Well, indio is, like it or not, it's a part of our, it's a circumstance of our history. We were called indios, it was a pejorative term, but it meant conquered people, it meant conquered cultures, it meant cultures that were hybridized, cultures that were Indianized, cultures that were bastardized. So it's a fact of life, but in spite of that Indianization of our culture, the genius of the indigenous culture is still there. So I tried to twist it a little bit further and tell my students, come on, let's work with our indigenous strengths. In other words, accept our being Indios, even if it was pejorative for the Spanish. But we can't undo that. We can't push a delete button and take out all those foreign influences. But work with it, and if we acknowledge it, I think we can become we can really contribute to the world, no? Mm-hmm. Our culturally, yeah.
Yeah. What can you say about contemporary Philippine cinema that's outside working outside of the traditional studio systems?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've missed the last two Cinemalaya festivals. I was out of town for both, and I haven't caught up with that. But generally, it's been a healthy development that at least institutionally there's some support for indie filmmaking. Of course, that always brings you to a matter of definition, what is really the independent film. And some people are complaining now that many of the Cinemalaya films are beginning to look like commercial films. I think independence doesn't have to do with whether the films can be slick or become more technically polished, or whether these films might start even to have bigger budgets. I think it's just the independent spirit of the director who is able to tell the story from his, I call it the point of view of your duende. Well, the duende is a Spanish word, no? But we talk about the duende of the forest or the duende of the river. It's some kind of entity that is in that rock or in that forest or in that river. We also have our own duende. I call it sariling duende. Our sarili means my very own. And let's not let that word sarili to mean ego, my duende, my point of view, my story. It's more just that your story, your local story, that as you only you can tell it, is waiting to be told. So as a filmmaker on film, or as a writer, or as a painter on canvas, yung point of view ng duende mo is what the world is waiting for. You know, many of my students or young filmmakers come to me and say, sir, what does it take to become a world-class artist or filmmaker? I said, I don't think you become world-class because you copy and you do Star Wars 24 or Rush Hour 55. The world is waiting for your duende story. It's your special POV that nobody else could have told this story in this way. And it's your duende is mainly influenced by the way you frame your world. It's how your duende was formed because from your personal experiences as growing up, and combined with the cultural influences of your community or where you live, the combination of your special, where you grew up, if your father was a my favorite example, if your father was a fascist type and say, no, 2 plus 2 is not 5. Bug agad. You would have a different way of interpreting the world. And let's say if your father was a gentle, even feminine, anak, 2 plus 2, baka naman. Iba yung sagot, hanapin natin. I mean, things like this affect the way you frame the world. Mm-hmm. Then, if your culture, if you grew up in a village like Forbes Park Village, where you have yayas to do everything for you, and you can't even pick up your own bag or baggage, and compared to the Ifugao kids who learn to pick up heavy boulders early enough in age to start repairing rice terraces, or let's say children, you see people wearing G-strings, so it's normal to see a butt. Mm-hmm. And in the cities, the colegialas will see somebody in a G-string giggling and laughing about these uncivilized people. So, again, this combination of your cultural filters and your personal framings will give you a duende that can only do a story in a certain way. I mean, all the technical side, good camera work, good sound, that's all technical. Those are just finishing touches. But the backbone of your story has to come from your duende.
Are Filipino-American duendes the same or different?
Well, I think the unique thing that you've grown up in America, and then you have parents like you, your parents talk to you in Tagalog, mm-hmm. so because you can at least understand Tagalog, you'll probably have a different set of inputs, not limited just to what Mother America teaches you, but maybe because you have some that you can overhear conversations, or you can understand Tagalog movies. So your duende will have a very different texture from somebody who grew up at home. And this does not hinder you from being creative in a Filipino way. You have a unique point of view that, and many Filams also have that. And I think that's all. You just have to nurture your duende so that your duende is the one who tells the story or paints that canvas. It's your point of view. And I think the world is waiting for such kinds of unique angles to look at the world.
Random question. In Perfume Nightmare, And this is kind of like outside of the film, but what happens to the guy with the butterfly tattoo on his chest? That image just resonates with me for some reason. Mm. I mean, probably because I have tattoos, but...
You mean what happened to the person? Yeah. Or in the story? Or
what? No, what happened to the actual individual?
Actually, he lived in the... That's the village of my father, no? Uh-huh. And Yeah, I guess he became the bomb man because the day I was shooting that hut going up, he was the guy shaving those bamboo to use them for, to clean them up for using them for poles. And he had a strong presence. So suddenly I asked him to play the role of Kaya, the best friend of Kidlat in the film. Well, apparently he had been an ex-convict, so that's probably why he had tattoos. In those days, not like today. It's an in thing to have tattoos, no? But in those days, it was mainly the convicts who had that. But I understand he's died. I don't know what circumstance, but he died maybe about 10 years ago. Mm. Wow, that film's almost 40 years old.
Yeah.
77, or 35 years.
Yeah, I remember seeing it for the first time and just being completely astounded because I was usually the only Filipino in my class. Mm-hmm. And so I felt special, mm-hmm. you know? I'm like, oh, I get what he's saying. So it's an honor for me to meet you, for one thing. And when I did go to Baguio in 2008, although I couldn't find you, I went to your your cafe.
Oh, my gulay.
Yeah, oh, my gulay. Yeah, I loved it there. I know you're getting up there in age, but any other projects? Are you still going to finish out the Magellan film?
Okay, that's, I think that might be one of my culminating activities. Yeah, a lot of people have asked me, even many years ago, my students would ask, sir, when are you going to finish that film about the slave of Magellan, Enrique de Malacca? I guess my philosophical attitude towards a lot of these things is it'll be finished when it's finished. I'm not going to break my back just to try and get it into a market slot. Well, I'm an extreme. I'm not asking anybody to follow it. I'd be glad if the film could make a little money so you can make my next film. But as you said, maybe at this age, you're not thinking so much about those next films. But I would like to, I'm showing this on Sunday, Memories of Overdevelopment is the working title. What means working? I've been working on that film for 32 years. It's a long time work in progress. Just a little bit more tweaking so that, because I often have to introduce the film because it's not complete. So I have to fill in some blanks about who the slave of Magellan was and why he's known, who has recorded him, and that beyond being a fictitious character, he might have become the first man to circumnavigate the globe. I need a few little tidbits to include so that even if I'm not around, the film can be shown. So I think it's doable at this stage of my life, and it won't require raising a Hollywood budget. All I want to do is let the world know the first man who circumnavigated the globe was not one of the conquistadors or the materially rich countries, but was from most possibly from our country, where our country as it is now, because he could speak the language of the Cebuanos. That's the key to understanding why he became the first person to go around the globe.
And one last question. I mean, you've been traveling the world for years, and I feel like you're a man of the planet. Like your heart is deeply connected with the earth. In conclusion, what can you say about where the world is at today environmentally?
You know, I mean, besides being a filmmaker, I'm involved in several other advocacies, and you know, they have an indirect effect with all environmental balance or spiritual balance, or anyway, the holistic being that is not constantly adding to the imbalance that we witness today, imbalances in environmental approach, imbalances in economic balance, I mean, imbalances in economic motivations, where we can balance material and the non-material sides of us. On the whole, we have so much still at home. And my last few years, I've been very active with the indigenous people. I built a hut in the Ifugao Terrace system, and I've been adopted by a village there. But last June, my wife and I convened an international powwow of indigenous tribes, mainly 25 ethnic groups from the Philippines who are trying to preserve their cultures through schools of living traditions, who see the danger of going to the public school system, which is just constantly trying to make us good global citizens economically and materially, instead of emphasizing some of the assets we have as people who come from this part of the world with unique sets of with unique ways of viewing the world or with unique spiritual hierarchies. So it's if we allow these expressions that are still alive in our tribal people, they have ancestral ancient knowledge about ecosystems. They knew how to just get what you need instead of abusing the earth. What I call cultural prenos, you know, cultural breaks. They had the collective cultural breaks that did not allow them to just ravage the environment. I think they have still a lot to teach, you know, these countries that are out of control because globalization and material accumulation and, yeah, let's call it greed, materially has become a way of life, and always at the expense of our planet. So if we revive some of these, it's not about going back to the Stone Age, you know, just if we revive a lot of these indigenous wisdoms, ecological wisdoms that their old systems knew, and maybe inject these into a lot of the modern societies, maybe there's a hope that we can balance out all these excesses like global warming or like economies going out of hand because of the 1%. These are people who just lost their breaks, their culture breaks. Less war. So it's all tied to this overkill in terms of economic progress without seeing with the much longer effects. And the signs are now around, no? It's very mm-hmm. clear. I mean, I think I was, yeah, in New York when Hurricane Sandy came over. It's happening more and more often. Mm-hmm. But it's very humbling also. And if the hubris, all this technological hubris doesn't allow some humbling, so to say, hey, is there some handwriting on the wall? Should we listen to these new patterns of environmental anger of the planet raging because it's been abused and exploited for the last century and a half? And then let those voices of the indigenous people tell us where to temper. I think this is the role. And maybe filmmakers who can spot these things can help spread that holistic outlook. Until, you know, I mean, people always talk about the power of media. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's being used for the wrong. I mean, well, I don't want to say right or wrong, but just unfortunately, it's used for just exploiting values that easily sell, mm-hmm. without considering the long-run effects on a culture or on a people. And so if the kind of power play you always see in films, the greed, those who are driven by power seeking people, which are always glorified in films, mm-hmm. as long as they continue to be the main stay of commercial films, and Hollywood is the best example of these commercial formulas. What is it doing to encourage more people to do this? It's subconscious. It's not really saying it per se, but visually, these are the images that the next generation sees, mm-hmm. at the expense of the more balanced values that the simpler people had, mm-hmm. or the indigenous people still have. Mm-hmm. Can we get that message out? Can the filmmakers, instead of just filming blockbusters, try to tell the local story? That's what my installation is going to be about. I put a little installation whenever I have film screenings. Mm-hmm. And it's to encourage the telling of the local story. You'll see it later. Maybe you can even help me put it up.
Okay. I think that's it. Thank you again.
Yeah. It's always, you know, my last stop always is here, usually on the way home. It's, not only because it's on the same ocean as we are, but it was here that Perfume Nightmare was first shown, here at Pacific Film Archives. And eventually Tam Ladi, who was the former curator of Pacific Film Archives, had kept custody of my film while I was traveling eastward. Mm-hmm. He took the chance to show it to Francis Coppola, who at that time was, as he described it, going crazy with his four endings for Apocalypse Now. So Tam Ladi said, hey, here, come and get your mind off that thing. Let's watch a crazy Filipino film that I happen to have. And yeah, he liked the film and he borrowed the print. There was no DVDs in those days, no? He took the whole print and projected it to his family and friends in San Francisco. And a year later, he was asking if they could distribute the film. He said, this is a film Americans should see. And unfortunately, none of the other normal distributors, even in the indie distributors, wanted to risk distributing a film, an unknown film from an unknown country. So thanks to that connection, at least if you put Francis Ford Coppola presents Kidlat Tahimik, then the cinemas are willing to take a risk. Mm-hmm. So that gave me a good exposure. I didn't make lots of money. I mean, just the endorsement allowed cinemas to take risks, and therefore more people saw it. So that's why the Bay Area has a special sentimental value for me as a young filmmaker. Then, I just turned 70, but it's still a good memory to mm-hmm. want to linger through on my way back home.
Yeah, I also remember other articles about your travels with Werner. And one story talked about how the two of you went to the most obscure location, and the objective was to cultivate your audience. And yeah. I still take that with me. I remember that story.
Werner Herzog, he's a mentor for me in much more of a, not necessarily with filmmaking technique or storytelling. It's more an attitude of an independent. So that time when I'd shown him a treatment of my film about the Slave of Magellan, mm-hmm. and I wanted to get some reactions, and he was so busy in Munich, he said, I have no time, but look, this weekend I'm driving to Cologne, 400 kilometers away, show a film there and then come back. I'll be alone. If you want, there's a time where we can discuss it. You'll have me all to yourself. So I joined him on the trip. We went 400 kilometers, showed this film to about 25 people. Then we hopped back on the bus and on his Volkswagen Kombi and drove back. And then I asked him, Kidlat, I Werner, why do you drive 800 kilometers for a handful of... Oh, Gilad, we must develop our audiences. And that stuck with me. I mean, it's true. Maybe in the normal sense, you're always thinking, ah, it's nice to have full houses. And it's more efficient if you can spread the gospel through a big audience. But, and he said, well, I would drive there even if there were only 2.5 people in that audience. And that stuck with me a lot. Of course, one other thing I can remember, why I think of him as a mentor, is when I was going back to the Philippines, I decided that I didn't want to let my kid have a Wernher von Braun education. So as we were parting ways, he said, good kid, lad. You know, you can never be a good Bavarian director. It took me a little time to figure that out. But all he was saying was, don't aspire to be a Bavarian director, don't aspire to be a Hollywood director, just be your Filipino, your duende-driven Filipino filmmaker. And I think that's an influence that has strongly kept me independent and relevant maybe to my Pinoy self as a filmmaker.
I'd still say, actually, you're really relevant to Filipino filmmaking now. I think that's all I wanted to say. I also wanted to say thank you. Maraming salamat talaga. Like, oh man, I tell you, is without Perfume Nightmare, without knowing your existence, I would not feel okay being a filmmaker. I'd always feel like something is missing. Mm-hmm. But because of Perfume Nightmare, because of what you've done with your humor, with your bravery, with your honesty, I felt that I too can be brave and honest as someone who is not white, who is not entirely American and not entirely Filipino. So thank you.
Well, you can use those sides of you to let your unique duende, your non-white duende, your Pinoy duende, to tell that unique story. It's not a question of, it's not even a question of whether blacks or browns can tell superior stories to whites. It has nothing to do with that. It's always letting, I'm sure Wernher Herzog has his own duende, Coppola has his own duende, Kurosawa. So I always encourage my students then, yeah, by all means, study the masters, but don't study them to idolize them and copy them shot for shot, but understand how their duende were cultivated and eventually got freed. Then you can act on your own duende and free it to tell its own story. We can tell our own story, what color ever we are, but we just have to find a source of strength from our indigenous duende.
That was Gilad Tahimik, and you can catch his final screenings this weekend. Check the link on our website at apexexpress.org. This is your host, RJ Lozada. Thanks for listening.